No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I hope my show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. Tonight we have a really great guest, Ari Berman. Ari is a national voting rights correspondent for Mothers Jones, what a great publication, and a reporter at Type Media Center. He is the author of three books, Minority Rule, Give Us the Ballot, and Herding Donkeys. And as a Democrat of 40 years, I love that title because herding the Democrats is a lot like herding cats. His writing has also appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, in Rolling Stone, and he's a frequent commentator on MSNBC and NPR. He won the Sidney Hillman Foundation Prize for Magazine Journalism and an Izzy Award for Outstanding Achievement in Independent Media. Thank you so much for being on the show, Ari. We so much appreciate having you.
Hey, Senator Brown. Great to talk to you. Thanks so much.
So let me start your first book. You know, I don't know where you come up with these titles, but they're great. The first book really intrigued me. Minority Rule, the right wing attack on the will of the people and the fight to resist it. Now, my opinion is that, yeah, we all know they attacked us, but are we really doing a good job in fighting it? What do you think? Tell us what the book's about, really.
Well, so Minority Rule is my most recent book, which was published in April of this year. And it's really about the attempt by an elite conservative white minority to hold power despite not having a majority of support in their attempt to try to undermine the will of the majority through anti-democratic tactics like voter suppression, gerrymandering, dark money, the stacking of the courts. And this newer anti-democratic movement is, of course, also taking advantage of longstanding inequities in our political system, such as the Electoral College, such as the structure of the U.S. Senate and the Congress, such as the Supreme Court. So it's really about the interaction of these two anti-democratic movements, one of which is relatively new and one of which is very old.
Well, and it really is the case that they're making the most out of the institutional things that you're talking about. And it always seems to me that as Democrats, we're a day late and a dollar short on these issues. I mean, are we doing enough to fight voter suppression? I know at the state level, the Republicans are just going crazy right now. Conservative Republicans working at the state level to try to change things to give them a better outcome in November. Are we doing enough to fight that?
Well, I think Democrats should have done more. I think the biggest thing Democrats could have done is do things at the federal level when they had majorities in the Congress and controlled the presidency. They didn't prioritize voting rights legislation until it was too late. They never really prioritized things like giving representation to Washington, D.C., which I know is your major issue.
Yeah,
they didn't really promote structural reform. They kind of buried discussions about what to do about the Supreme Court. And so I think on the federal level, I think the idea of President Biden was try to pass popular policies and that will show people that democracy will work. Well, the problem is they did pass policies. They weren't necessarily all that popular and people still don't think democracy is working. And the problem is they haven't really changed any of the system that allowed Donald Trump to be elected in the first place. And so we still have a broken system in Washington. We still have all these voter suppression laws in the states. It's hard to challenge them through the courts because the courts are dominated by conservative justices. So I think we really needed federal legislation when Biden took over to protect people's right to vote, to give representation to disenfranchised communities. And that didn't happen. And so now I think the Democrats are at a position where they're on defense on these critical democracy issues.
Yeah, and it seems to me that that's been an Achilles heel for the Democrats for a long time, is that, you know, when you talk about some of the problems are long time and short term and some of them short term. You know, when I was at the DNC many years, we were a poor substitute for the RNC. And the RNC did all sorts of things at a structural level, trained candidates, they had candidate academies and all these sorts of things that we didn't have. You know, we didn't have the resources in those days. Of course, that's all changed now. We do have the resources. I think that the Democrats are raising more money than the Republicans as a rule lately. But so are we locked into that like old way of doing things and we just can't see the forest for the trees? What's that about?
I mean, I think when Republicans get in there, they're very focused on how to change the system to benefit themselves. I mean, I think that's a theme over and over again, is what can we do to make the system more advantageous for Republicans? So how can we preserve all of the counter-majoritarian aspects of American politics, or even deepen them, so that we can remain in power for as long as possible? And I think when Democrats get in there, they think about, okay, how can we pass policies that we think will improve people's lives, which I think is a very worthy goal in terms of what they try to do here. But the problem is, if you're trying to pass popular policies within a broken system, it's going to be very, very difficult for those policies to become law. So, for example, you could make an argument, and again, I know it's your issue, but you could make an argument that DC voting rights would have been one of the first things Democrats should have pushed, because not only was there a moral case for it in terms of, as you said, the last colony, a place that has more people than Wyoming, but no representation in terms of that actually counts, right? In terms of the House or the Senate. And, you know, Wyoming has 100,000 fewer people than DC, but it has one member of Congress and two senators, right? And so you could make an argument for a moral reason. You could make an argument for lots of reasons on why to support that, but that was always a back burner issue. Even the issue of voting rights, which directly related to the insurrection at the Capitol, trying to prevent Republicans from stealing another election, trying to make sure that there were basic standards for how people could vote no matter where they lived. That was something that the Biden administration only pushed, remember, after a lot of his other agenda had stalled, after the Build Back Better bill was defeated, or Joe Manchin walked away from it. And the thing is some of these things are going to be hard to change. Like, it's really, really difficult to change the fundamental nature of the Senate. It's a lot easier to pass legislation that would give DC actual voting rights. So I think that Democrats have pushed aside a lot of these structural issues and says, oh, they can wait another day. The problem is, they then become cannibalized, essentially, by the broken system that they refuse to change.
Well, and, you know, that's been my argument for a long time, Ari, is that, you know, I say there was $800 million spent in elections in Georgia by both sides to get two Democratic senators. If you spent $800,000, $800 million trying to get voting rights or statehood for the District of Columbia, you'd get two more Democratic senators. And we know they'd be Democrats, right? Because we have no Republicans in Washington. We've never voted for a Republican for president. It's part of our problem in dealing with the Republicans, actually. We've never voted for a Republican for president. We have no Republican elected officials. We've never had a Republican mayor, you know. So it's pretty sure that you would get two liberal Democrats out of that. And yet, it's an anemic effort on our part. We go up there and we say, we p- pay taxes, and we fight it on moral grounds. We pay taxes, we fight in wars, we're American citizens, we're good citizens. But the truth is, every single member of Congress in both houses already knows that, and that's not the fight. The fight isn't about what's right or wrong. The fight is, like you say, it's all about the structure. So what can we do at this point about that?
Well, I mean, I think people have to keep pushing for these things. I think that if there were to be a Democratic majority in the Congress, and if the president were to be reelected, I think that issues like voting rights would come to the forefront again. I know a lot of Democrats are committed to push for this. I think there's been a lot of support within the Democratic caucus for changing the rules on the filibuster. If you look, the two Democrats who opposed changing the filibuster to pass voting rights legislation, they're no longer Democrats anymore, and they're no longer going to be in the Congress anymore, Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin. So if they're replaced by Democrats that do support changing the filibuster to pass voting rights legislation, that creates a pathway for national voting rights legislation. It also could create a pathway for things like D.C. statehood. Imagine if the situation was reversed. Let's say the capital of the United States was in North Dakota, but North Dakota had no voting rights, but there was 600,000 voters that they knew would automatically be Republicans. The first thing they would do was give voting rights to those places, because that's what they quite literally did. They created North and South Dakota.
They did.
Four Republican senators instead of two. So, I mean, like, the whole idea that, like, the Senate is this sacrosanct body, like, states have been manipulated over and over in America in terms of new territories becoming states, in terms of who's admitted to the union, to try to create a situation that's better for one party or another. And so, I mean, it's fundamentally unfair. I mean, you can make a moral case that has nothing to do with politics for why D.C. should be a state with real representation in the Congress. But even if you just left aside the moral case, just in terms of pure power politics, it's crazy that Democrats haven't pushed this issue more. In the same way that I think it's crazy that Democrats haven't tried to do more about the current structure of the Supreme Court, for example. Do they really think that the six conservative justices are going to rule in their favor over and over again, or are going to be harder on them if they decide to create more accountability with this court? I mean, the fact is that I think that Democrats have not used the power they have. And I think that's the frustrating thing here, is in terms of what people can do, I think people felt like they elected a Democratic majority in Washington. And granted, it was a slim Democratic majority, but they elected a Democratic majority in Washington because they wanted to see progress on these issues. And if they didn't see progress, they at least wanted to see a fight. And I feel like they didn't see the progress, and they also, in a lot of cases, didn't even see an effort to try to fight these battles, whether it's on D.C. statehood, on the Supreme Court, on voting rights, or on other issues.
Well, yeah, and that's exactly what's happened. You know, and we've never done this. There's so many issues that you could bring up where you could say the same thing that the Democrats. So the Equal Rights Amendment has never passed. I'm 70 years old, Ari, and when I was in college, it was the big issue, the Equal Rights Amendment, and it still hasn't passed, you know, and isn't that crazy? But we never put a push behind it, you know, and that was a classic example to me, because they had a housewife from Indiana who sat up there and said, if you pass this, your daughters will be immediately put into combat. Meanwhile, the Democrats had people like Alan Alda and Jane Fonda and all these people on TV saying support ERA, and they didn't appeal to anybody who didn't already support ERA. The woman, Phyllis Schlafly, had a general, a woman general who had made it in a man's world, do her commercials and say exactly that. Your daughters would be put into combat. It's just crazy that we don't get that. And you know, so let me ask you, if I believe this is still true. Will Rogers said, I belong to no organized political movement. I'm a Democrat. is that our problem? Because we say, since I've been in politics, we say Democrats fall in love and Republicans fall in line. Is that really our biggest problem? Is that, and I think Trump is the obvious the obvious example of that. They're all behind him, you know, even though they have to know he's ridiculous. They have to know the things they're saying aren't true, but it just doesn't matter to them.
Yeah.
Whereas the Democrats, we're always fighting each other.
Well, I mean, if you look at the polls, more Republicans are behind Trump than Democrats are behind Biden.
Right.
And that's pretty remarkable. Now, I think there's legitimate reasons why people wanted someone other than Biden to run. So I'm not saying that everyone should be for Biden. I don't take positions on those kind of things. But I think it's pretty remarkable that almost every Republican is behind Trump, given the record that he had in office and then after office. And it's also amazing that he's even in the position to run again, given the things that he did. So I think the problem with the Democrats. So to me, it's three things. It's one, a lack of new leadership, because I think implicit in Biden running was that he said he was a bridge to a new generation, but that new generation has not emerged. So I think people want new leadership. And I think there were people outside of Washington that could have represented a fresher face for the Democratic Party, but they were not put forward for president. So I think that's one issue. The second thing is people want to know what the Democratic Party is for. It seems like the entire campaign right now is about Donald Trump and who he is. And I get that. That threat makes perfect sense. But people want to know, if Biden is reelected, what's he going to do, right? And that's almost completely missing from the president's message. And then there's a question of what is the Democratic Party going to fight for? And I think that we've seen this rollback of so many rights, whether it's voting rights, abortion rights, other rights. And I think people want to know that the Democratic Party is going to stand up and fight for those rights. And it feels like at times, they're criticizing Republicans for doing all these things, for passing abortion bans or passing new restrictions on voting or what have you, but they're not actually doing enough to fight against them. So to me, that's my big problem with the Democratic Party. I think there's a lot of Democrats at the state and local level that are doing a good job. And I think there's quite a few Democrats in Washington that are doing a good job to try to elevate these kind of things. But I think in terms of the national leadership of the Democratic Party, it's not clear what they stand for and who the party even is in terms of the next generation of leadership.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And you know, is that a structural problem inside the party that we're not bringing up new leaders? You know, I think my daughters both will stand there and tell me, we don't need to elect another old white guy. And I always say, I'm not offended by that, but okay, you know, and they really feel that, you know, and I got to tell you, I know you wrote some stuff about Howard Dean and his, and I want to talk to you about that in a minute, but you know, I was there as a superdelegate. I'm a superdelegate now. I was an Obama superdelegate, and by virtue of my office, I'm still a superdelegate. But I was there. I was actually at the – to talk about structural changes, we actually did that when I was at the DNC. A bunch of people got together, and I was involved in that process. And we laughed about it. We said, these guys will never come into play. They don't matter. Nobody, you know. But lo and behold, you know, recently with Obama and going forward, they have come into play. But, you know, have we not done enough to bring up people in the ranks? I look at what the Republicans have done. You know, I look at people like Kristi Noem and Bobart and the lovely lady from Georgia, you know, Green. And I go, oh, my God, these are the kind of people they're putting forth. We can't do a better job than that. And then what do you think? We're just not bringing people up through the party system?
Well, I mean, I think there were people at the state level that could have been elevated. There were, you know, Gretchen Whitmer, the governor of Michigan, comes to mind. Wes Moore, the governor of Maryland, comes to mind. In terms of, you know, fresh faces. I think that the problem is that, you know, Democrats didn't want to challenge Biden, because I think Democrats like Biden personally. They like him. Yes. They like him as a person. And so they might feel like he's too old. We want a fresh face. But they didn't want a big primary challenge because they were worried about the threat of Trump. And they felt like Biden defeated Trump once. He can defeat Trump again. That may turn out to be a mistaken assumption, according to the polls. I certainly think Biden could defeat Trump, but I also, it's very likely that Biden could lose to Trump. And the question is, would another Democrat have been stronger? Then there's the whole debate about Kamala Harris. Would she be stronger to defeat Trump? Clearly, I think people inside the Biden world didn't feel like it. They didn't feel like Biden could pass the torch to his vice president. So then what do you do? If you're not going to pass the torch to your vice president, which was the obvious thing, then it starts to get messy, right? And people that are looking at future leadership, they don't want to jump ahead and be the one that challenges an incumbent president or an incumbent vice president. So I think there was a lot of kind of rallying around the leader in the Democratic Party. The problem is that I think there's been a lack of democracy within the Democratic Party that is not the same as the lack of democracy in the Republican Party. But basically, Biden is saying, I'm the only person who can do this. And he's dismissing people who say you can't. And I think, you know, I don't think you should always base decisions on public opinion. But when 70% of Americans are saying don't run again, I think that's something that you have to take into consideration, that at some point you've lost the public's faith. And that's, I don't think the kind of depths of the unpopularity, I don't think Democrats have fully wrestled with. Because one of my main critiques of Republicans is they're trying to do all these unpopular things, right? They're trying to take away women's right to choose. They're trying to roll back gun control efforts. They're trying to pass these crazy restrictions on voting, all these things that are unpopular they're trying to do. But Democrats aren't trying to do unpopular things. But unfortunately, they do have an unpopular candidate that they are essentially saying you should accept because the other guy is more unpopular or more of a threat. And I think that doesn't really give people a reason to vote for something, which a lot of people need to be able to vote.
Well, and you know, I'm a very good campaigner. I've won several campaigns with very little money, and I've worked on many presidential campaigns. And right now, the Democrats, I want your input on this, are violating my number one rule in campaigning, which is don't let your opponent dictate your strategy. You know, I see Biden out there all the time, and guess what? He looks old.
Yeah.
He was invigorated. He was invigorated for that speech in front of the for the State of the Union speech. He did a great job. But it is hard for him to get up and down the steps. It is hard. So why do they keep on dragging him out, I say to myself. And then to hear things like the reporter saying, you know, something about somebody will kick your ass, and him saying, yeah, I'll kick their ass and I'll kick your ass too. What? Are you kidding me? Now you're going to be a badass? I think of John Kerry going out grouse hunting 2 days before the election to show he was a gun advocate. I think of Dukakis and the guy saying, climb in the tank, it'll make you look like a leader. You know what I mean? And this is what I see going on with Biden right now. I think they're headed in the wrong direction. Instead of doing what you just said about highlighting what they're doing in policy and also working on structural change, they're trying to out-Trump Trump. And that's just not going to work.
Well, I mean, I think the age thing is very tough because it's hard to make a case that Biden isn't too old to be president. I mean, you could also, by the way, I think you could make the same case about Trump.
Right.
The problem is that case about Trump isn't being made, that Trump is crazy and old and senile too. Because people are more concerned about Biden. So I think what one of Trump's potential vulnerabilities gets taken off the table. Then the problem is that the critique that a lot of younger people have of Biden, that he's kind of an out-of-touch white guy, is magnified by some of the policy problems they have. You know, like the critique of the incursion into Gaza is the perfect example of this. They feel like Biden is too old and out of touch, and therefore he's not responding to their critiques of this. And again, I think that's another issue where, you know, what is the moral case for backing Israel's right to do whatever they want in Gaza? I can see the case for they had a right to go in. But at this point, it's so far gone in terms of their actions. And he's been very slow to respond to shifting public sentiment on this issue, particularly to shifting public sentiment in the Democratic base, which is that the war is very unpopular. They don't feel like America has been even-handed. They feel like American policy has been slanted towards Israel. They don't understand why it remains that way. They might have understood why it was like that historically or why it was like that after Hamas attacked Israel. They don't understand why it's still like that based on Israel's actions. They'd like the United States to do more, try to end the war and bring the conflict to the close. And actually, I think Biden wants to do that too. I think Biden would like to end the war and bring the conflict to a close.
Right.
So I think that's an issue where the age and the policy are feeding into each other in something that has a really negative way. And I think that the Democrats, particularly Biden, are going to have to be more responsive to public opinion, particularly within public opinion on the Democratic base on this issue. Because if young voters don't show up, if voters of color don't show up, if they abandon the Democratic Party, it's going to be very, very hard for Democrats to win in November.
Right. And they should know that because that's been a problem for them in the past. And, you know, that I would think that when I thought about Hillary Clinton, I said to myself, what would you do if you were like the project manager and you got the resumes, you know, Secretary of State, 8 years in the White House, honors graduate of Yale Law School, blah, 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 all the way down to, and then you saw Trump's resume, a reality TV star, you know, I mean, how could you pick him, you know? But it's a strange thing in politics that people have to like you. They have to find you likable to vote for you, I think, very often. And Biden is likable, but the age thing is a real barrier, and they're really going about it wrong. And they didn't explain to begin with, you know, to say we support Israel because we've always supported Israel, instead of saying, being honest about it and say we support Israel. They're our strongest ally in the Middle East. We understand now that they're overreacting, but they're overreacting because 80 years ago, we tried to kill every Jew on the planet.
Yeah.
You know, so they're saying never again, never again, never again. And we understand that. And so it's up to us to go in and say, okay, enough is enough. Take control, run Gaza, do everything, but you got to stop killing civilians, even though Hamas hides among the civilians. And now they're saying they're casualties that, you know, they're acceptable casualties and all this other crazy crap, you know. So since we're on the subject, and you sound like you're Jewish to me, what do you think about the rise of anti-Semitism? I mean, it seems like every time there's ever a problem that that involves the Jewish community, immediately there's this pushback. Do you think that's something we need to worry about now?
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, anti-Semitism is rising, not just in America, but certainly abroad too. I mean, you're seeing these European far right parties that include kind of fascist and neo-Nazi elements get back in power. So I think it's really alarming. But I also, you know, for myself as someone who's Jewish, I also think it's dangerous for American Jews to always be associated with Israel, you know,
right.
Because the thing is, a lot of American Jews don't like the government of Israel at all. Right.
Right. Right. Right.
They particularly don't like Netanyahu.
Right.
They feel like Netanyahu is a Trump-like figure. I mean, to me, one of the main reasons why Netanyahu doesn't want to end the war is because he ends the war and then he gets prosecuted, just like Trump does. I mean, he's facing a huge corruption issue. He tried to change the courts just like Trump wants to do in Israel so he wouldn't be prosecuted. So, I mean, he is a very Trumpy figure. I think Netanyahu is smarter than Trump. I think he's more polished than Trump. But he's a very Trump-like figure that he wants to preserve his own power first and foremost. And I think he's basically using the war as leverage to try to make himself popular and to try to stay out of jail as well. And I think that a lot of Jewish people, including a lot of Jewish Democrats, are uncomfortable with the idea of American Jews and American policy more broadly being so closely aligned with Israel. For example, the invitation of Netanyahu to speak to the Congress. That's completely has divided the Democratic Party. There's some people that have total support of it, and there's a lot of people that don't think it should happen, that want the U.S. to support Israel, but don't want the U.S. to support Netanyahu and the current way he's waging this war. And so, again, I think that there's been too much of an effort by the Democratic leadership to try to appease Netanyahu as opposed to challenging him for a policy that's increasingly unpopular, not just at home, but around the world. And I think it's also having a negative impact on perception of Jews in America right now.
Well, and I think that, you know, I've been sensitive to that for a long time, because I've got to tell you real quickly, when I was 15 years old, I was orphaned, and I was, we didn't have very much money. And so I started working full time when I was 14, and I worked in a family owned Jewish clothing store when I was 15 as a stock boy. And when my mother passed, everybody in the store reached out to me and embraced me and treated me like family and, said, we love you and we're here to support you. And so I got to be honest with you. I could count on one hand all the Jews I've met in my life that I didn't like. And I think Netanyahu would probably be at the top of the list. Oh, and I come from an Italian family, and it's my opinion that Italians are the lost tribe of Israel, because my mother, I would put my Catholic Italian mother's use of guilt up against any Jewish mother on the planet. My mother was it was almost artistic to watch her work in guilt. And she was she could put herself into a self-induced coma at the drop of a hat. You said something she didn't like.
I'm married to a Catholic, so I think we have a lot in common in that sense.
Yeah, she was really great at it. But they're wonderful, wonderful people, the American Jews that I know, and I always feel bad when this happens, when people don't understand. And the one comment that Netanyahu made that I agree with, when he talks about college kids on campus protesting and stuff, is they have no sense of history. They have, he said they can't remember what they had for breakfast. And there's some truth in that. You know, my kids have no sense of history. I try to talk about civil rights, and they talk about it like this is ancient history. And I tell them I went to New Orleans when I was 8 years old, and I remember the white drinking fountains and the black drinking fountains. And I remember... Yeah. I remember, I remember my father getting into restaurants that said members only. And I would say, Dad, you have to be a member. And he said, don't worry, we're members, because we were white, and we were.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I remember all those things. They weren't that long ago. They weren't ancient history. And kids say, don't. And all my kids are college educated. I mean, they're not, it's not like they're not, they haven't studied this stuff and stuff, but they act like it's ancient history, and they want to move forward. And that's our problem. And that's what I remember about Hillary Clinton on the first round. This is my take, and you tell me how you feel. But I remember that Hillary Clinton was the odds on favorite to get the Democratic nomination. Nobody questioned it. Nobody had any doubts about it. And then this guy named Neil Axelrod saw that people were supporting Hillary because they didn't have an option. Just like Biden. There were a lot of people that didn't want her, really, and were uncomfortable with her, but they didn't see any other option. Then he latched on to the caucuses, started to show that Obama was viable, and that was the start of the end for Hillary. And, and then Hillary got the nomination, I'm convinced, because women weren't going to have it any other way. In the Democratic Party, they weren't gonna allow themselves to be beaten out of the nomination twice. So they got her nominated the first time she ran against Trump. First time, when Trump won. But there's a possibility we could see that now, that somebody like Newsom or Gretchen Whitmer or somebody could rise up out of the pack. Now, we've never had a brokerage convention that I remember. I mean, you know, I've gone to every convention, last 13 nominating conventions I've been there. And I never remembered the first one that I was at. I worked on a campaign for Jimmy Carter to keep Ted Kennedy from getting the nomination. And I don't know if you're old enough to remember this, but Ted Kennedy made a floor movement to get the nomination, which was immediately defeated.
Yeah.
Had no legs at all. And that's the closest I've ever seen. Ever since then, I go to wherever and we go out and party. You know, I mean, everybody knows who the nominee is. We go to all the, you know, I'm a senator, so I get into all the cool parties. And you know, this one's in Chicago, and I'm going to take my daughter with me. You know, but we really have never had a fight for the nomination. You think there's any chance that that could happen over Biden?
Yeah, I mean, I think something extraordinary would have to happen. Because, like I said, people like Biden personally, and by and large, Democrats support him. So, and there's not, the issue is his age. There's not a defining policy issue. Usually there's a policy issue, like the war, that would lead Democrats to abandon the party. But that's, there's not really that issue. So it's kind of hard to say, like, you're too old and there's all these younger people. So, I mean, I think something extraordinary would have to happen to Biden, probably something to his health, to the point where he would have to stand down. And then I think the question is, well, his vice president is the most likely to stand up. And then, so how do you bypass her? I think there's also a lot of political questions about that too. I mean, I think basically what would have had to happen is a while ago, there would have had to essentially, Biden would basically have to step down, say he could have even endorsed Kamala Harris, but also said in some way, I think there should be a primary. There should be a Democrat should decide basically. So you have a primary. I don't think that would have been that bad, honestly. People seem to think that primaries are bad. But if the party comes together at the end, it's not a bad thing. I mean, there was a very hard-fought primary in 2008, as you know. And it was fine. And I think, you know, people wanted a fresh face, clearly, in 2008. Because the critique was Bush, Clinton, Bush, Clinton, Bush, Clinton. Are we just going to keep doing this? You know, are we just going to have a dynastic form of politics? And so they were looking for someone to break that form of dynasty. And then Obama came around and he was able to appeal to people and break that form of dynasty. And he seemed comfortable in his own skin. And he articulated a new vision for America, a new vision for America that's kind of lacking right now in terms of the Democrats. I think, I'm going to go back to one thing you said about the students. I think sort of, I don't think patronizing them is going to work. I think that trying to make the history accessible to them is really important. You know, I remember the 2000 election in Florida. I'm younger than you. That was my first presidential election I voted in. And I remember there was a lot of critiques of the Democratic Party that are similar to today, right? That the Democratic Party doesn't stand for anything. The Democratic Party is corrupt, that it's beholden to corporate America. And there's no difference between the parties. You heard that all the time. I don't think it was true, but you heard it all the time, right? And then a lot
That's
of people
true.
Said, I'm going to vote third party. I'm going to vote for Ralph Nader. I'm not going to vote at all. And it was that kind of attitude in an election that was decided by 537 votes in Florida that then got us the Supreme Court, that gutted the Voting Rights Act, that got us the Supreme Court, that overturned Roe v. Wade, that has done all these things that young people disagree with. And so, I mean, I think that sometimes an election can be the lesser of two evils, but one evil can be dramatically more evil than the other. And I think that's something that people don't understand. And then you're not just voting for a president. You're voting for an entire administration. You're voting for Supreme Court justices. You're voting for an entire cabinet. And I think that that's what people don't understand. They think it's Biden versus Trump, but look at the people Trump would put in versus people that Biden would put in. You can't argue that they're the same. And so I think trying to make a broader point about why voting matters is really important. And as you said, with terms of the civil rights movement, I mean, things like the Voting Rights Act are less than 60 years old. I mean, this is far from ancient history. I mean, the U.S. has not been a multiracial democracy in a real tangible way for all that long. I mean, 60 years is not a long time where people were prevented from voting and then got the right to vote. And so I think that there's a feeling like we can't go backwards, but we absolutely can go back. Maybe not to that day, but we can go back to a day where we have fewer rights and freedoms than we have now.
Well, shouldn't we have Democrats out there saying this, Ari, rather than just, late night Jimmy Kimmel? Shouldn't we be out there saying Secretary of State Marjorie Taylor Greene? Imagine that. Or, Secretary of, head of Homeland Security, Lauren Boebert. She'd be hands on. She'd be hands on the first day. You know, shouldn't we be saying things like that? Shouldn't we be out there saying to people, "Hey, man, it's not just about this one nut. It's about all the guys that are with him." You know,
for sure. I think most people don't even know who those people are. So I think that's the problem here. I mean, I think the problem with Trump is that, A, people have amnesia about the Trump years. I mean, it was amazing to me in recent polls that people had a positive remembrance of the Trump years. They don't remember the 100,000 people that died during COVID. They don't remember the insurrection. They don't remember all of the attempts to just the chaotic, incompetent, racist way that the government was run on, like, a daily basis. The rigging of trying to rig multiple elections, just the constant drama that was surrounding things. I mean, I think a lot of that has receded in people's memory. And so I think, first off, the historical amnesia is problematic. Secondly, I think there was a feeling like, okay, we survived the first Trump term, a second term wouldn't be so bad. Well, we barely survived the first Trump term. You combine the policies that he passed, then you talk about COVID, then you talk about the insurrection, and we barely survived it as a democracy and as a country itself. And then I think people don't realize that a second Trump term would be a lot worse than a first Trump term. And I think it would be worse because Trump is much more radical and retributionary than before. He's basically purged the Republican Party of all moderate elements. So it would be a much more extreme Republican Party. It would be a Republican Party dominated, as you said, by the Marjorie Taylor Greens, the Lauren Boeberts. And there's a whole program for what Trump would do that the conservative movement has bought into through Project 2025, where they basically outlined, this is how we're going to try to enact authoritarianism in all the different branches of government. And I don't think there wasn't that kind of buy-in after 2016. I think Republicans after 2016, they wanted Trump to cut taxes for the rich and appoint conservative judges. And Trump did those kind of things. But now there's a 900-page blueprint for what they want Trump to do. And Trump's just going to do it because he's going to just get people in there that are going to enact this radical agenda. So I think people also just don't realize how bad a second Trump term would be. And I think that's something that, in addition to talking about the affirmative agenda of what Democrats could do, I think that making the case for why Trump now would be worse than Trump before, I think is also really important and something that I'm not hearing a lot about right now.
Yeah, I mean, you say retributionary. I am your retribution. When did that become a campaign slogan? Wasn't it like Tippecanoe and Tyler too, or ask not what your country can do for you? I am your retribution. That's not I could tell you as an Italian kid from North New Jersey, that's a threat. It's not a campaign slogan, and people are embracing it. I mean, it's just absolutely crazy. And I got to tell you, I'm scared to death because you read the polls and you say to yourself, how can this man be ahead? How can he be ahead with all the stuff that's going on? Now, let me ask you, is Biden making a mistake here today with one foot on the platform and one foot on the train, standing up and saying about his son, which shouldn't have anything to do with anything because it's his son, it's not him. I mean, let's talk about the Trump children for a while, but saying, we love him and we support him and we represent and but we also stand behind the court and what the court does in the jury trial. I mean, Trump's out there saying this is a rigged system. It's the justice system, which I think is a mistake on his part, because if there's one thing that Americans believe in, they believe in juries. You know, I mean, poll after poll shows that Americans believe in the jury system. So I don't think anybody thinks that's rigged. But, you know, they just did a poll. I just read the other day that 44% of the American people believe that Trump won the last election.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, it's crazy. I mean, but the thing is that's not a majority. So, I mean,
right.
It's very concerning that so many people believe things that aren't true. And it's very concerning that so many Republicans, you know, 70% of Republicans believe the election is stolen. That's extremely concerning. That said, that is still a minority of the country. And that's why I'm writing about minority rule, because what I'm concerned about is not that there isn't a pro-democracy majority in this country. It's that the pro-democracy majority, in many cases, can't actually make its voices heard because it's blocked by all these structures that promote minority rule. And so that's why I think the systemic reform is so important. And in 2022, it was really interesting because there was all these races that basically came down to democracy was the defining issue. And at the governor's races, for example, did you want to support candidates like Carrie Lake in Arizona that might try to overturn future elections? Or did you want to stand up for candidates who would defend democratic norms? And by and large, the candidates who defended democratic norms, they were the ones that won. And so I think that, yes, Trump has been very successful in demonizing the system. But I also think that defending it is not such a bad thing. But I think what Democrats also need to point out is, yes, the system, Trump said the jury system is rigged. The jury system isn't rigged, but a lot of American democracy is rigged, but it's rigged right in a way that favors Republicans.
Right.
And that's what we don't hear enough about is, and that's what I was trying to do in the new book was talk about that, talk about the Electoral College and the U.S. Senate and the Supreme Court, and basically say there is a rigging of the system, but it's very different than the way Trump is talking about rigging it. It's rigging it so that this elite conservative white minority can rule instead of the will of the majority itself. And so to me, that's something that I think that Democrats need to do more, not just defend the current system, but also talk about how they would change it.
Well, when you talk about systemic change, isn't one of the things that really needs to be changed social media? Now, this is a very touchy issue, and as a journalist, I'm sure it's very concerning to you, given the First Amendment. But don't we need to do something? I mean, because you can find, I don't care what your nut idea is, you can find somebody out there that agrees with you. And I think most people don't search for the truth. They search for things that reinforce what they already believe. And so that's easy enough to find on social media. You know, one of my former employees was a bartender at Comet Pizza in Washington. I don't know if you remember the Comet Pizza incident. Yeah, they still bring it up. And there's still people that believe that Hillary Clinton was molesting children in the basement of a building that doesn't even have a basement. It's just crazy.
It's insane. It's insane. No, I'm extremely concerned about it. And I'm extremely concerned about it as a journalist because, you know, first and foremost, what we're trying to do is report the truth and give people facts and tell stories that are based on real lives and real events and real things that happened. And so many people are operating in a completely different sphere where their entire job is predicated on lies. And you look at 2020, on Twitter in 2020, lies about the election were flagged as lies. Things about COVID were flagged as lies, and they were taken down. Now, one of the biggest boosters of disinformation runs that platform.
Right.
And you look at TikTok. RFK Jr. has 5 times as many followers on TikTok as Joe Biden. So this is very, very deeply problematic. I don't think it's at all supporting journalism. I think it's completely opposed to journalism. And I think there should be far more regulation of these platforms. I think these platforms are acting in really, really undemocratic, in really, really harmful ways beyond the First Amendment. And I don't think that this, what they're doing is in line with the vision of a First Amendment. The First Amendment is supposed to be about a diversity of views, not the right to just lie outright with no consequences whatsoever. And these are for-profit institutions, so they're not public goods, and they should be regulated. And I think there should be far more regulation of the kind of content and how Facebook and Twitter and TikTok and all of these things are influenced these things, because a lot of the voters that are going to decide the election are unfortunately getting their news from these platforms, right? Even if they're not Trump supporters, even if they're not fully committed to the MAGA cause, they're getting their news from platforms that have a tremendous amount of disinformation and misinformation, where the truth itself is basically contested.
Well, and, you know, I know that my children get all their information from the internet. I don't even think they watch TV anymore. I think they even stream movies and everything through their computers. They're on their computers all the time. And my wife is a librarian. And my wife fights constantly with, you know, she's happy if she can get a kid to go to Wikipedia. You know, if their research doesn't go any deeper than that. But she's constantly struggling with trying to get kids to read books and trying to get them to look at alternative sources. And it's really, really hard. Well, we're running out of time. So first of all, you're a lot more brilliant than I thought you were. So tell people how they can get your books.
Oh, thanks so much. Well, as they say, they can get my books wherever books are sold. The best way is always to go to your local bookstore. If they have a copy, great. If they don't have a copy, they can order one for you. But it's obviously on Amazon and all those other places as well. One good resource is bookshop.org, because then you can find where the book is in stock at your local bookseller, and you can buy it that way.
Oh, that's a great idea. And do you have a website?
Yeah, my website is ariburmanauthor.com.
Well, and we're running out of time here, so my final question, is there anything you want to say that I didn't ask you?
No, I think we had a great conversation. I just want to, I wrote this new book because I wanted to connect the threats to democracy that we're facing right now to the threats that we faced over the last 230 years, and I wanted to people to understand that the crisis facing American democracy is older and deeper than Donald Trump, so people to understand the threat, but also understand what they can do about it, so that at this moment of existential emergency, they don't feel powerless about their power as citizens. So that's basically it.
Okay, well, let me just give you, because I like you, and let me give you a piece of advice from an old guy as a Catholic. Be good to your Catholic wife, because we not only have the guilt gene, we also have the retribution gene. So you have to be, you don't want to have to sleep with one eye open. So anyway, Ari Berman, thank you so much for being on my show. We always do a song, go out with a song that we dedicate to our guests. So this is for you, Ari. This is my favorite campaign song of all time. It was actually written by the candidate. It's called Every Man a King. So here, this is for Ari.
Awesome.
Thanks, folks,
thank you.
And listen next week. Thanks.
Give the people their right to vote.